Cases That Change People's Lives, the podcast series. You are very welcome to episode 3 in this series of Cases That Change People's Lives. Episode 3 involves an analysis of the legal complexities in the divorce case of Mrs. Catherine O'Shea in London in 1889, which involved and implicated Irish politician Charles Stuart Parnell. It had to be in London, for reasons given in the course of the observation in this episode, because at that time Ireland was directly ruled by the UK. The commentary on the divorce case, in which Irish politician Charles Stuart Parnell was the co-respondent, is provided by esteemed Irish lawyer, biographer and historian, Frank Callanan, Senior Counsel. I do hope that you enjoy this case and appreciate the significance that it had on Ireland at that time, the division of opinion about the case that ran deep, and the significance on the outturn of Irish history. Thank you.
The grounds were the adultery of Catherine O'Shea with the correspondent Charles Stuart Parnell.
That was tonight's guest, Frank Callanan, talking about one of the most scandalous cases in Irish legal history. Strictly speaking, of course, it was not an Irish case because the divorce of Captain O'Shea and his wife Catherine was held in a London court, but this celebrated case reverberated down through the years of Irish history. The controversy generated by the case even surfaced in James Joyce's A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. Here's how he recounted it.
"They are the Lord's anointed," Dante said. "They are an honour to their country."
"Trouble guts," said Mr. Dedalus coarsely.
"Really, Sammy, you should not speak that way before Stephen. It's not right." "Oh, he'll remember all this when he grows up," said Dante hotly. "The language he heard against God and religion and priests in his own home."
"Let him remember that too," cried Mr. Casey to her from across the table. "The language with which the priests and the priest pawns broke Parnell's heart and hounded him into his grave. Let him remember that too when he grows up."
"Sons of bitches," cried Mr. Dedalus. "When he was down, they turned on him to betray him and rent him like rats in a sewer. Low-lived dogs. And they look it, by Christ, they look it."
Dante shoved her chair violently aside and left the table, upsetting her napkin ring, which rolled slowly along the carpet and came to rest against the foot of an easy chair. At the door, Dante turned round violently and shouted down the room, her cheeks flushed and quivering with rage.
"Devil out of hell! We won! We crushed him to death! Fiend!"
The door slammed behind her. Mr. Casey, freeing his arms from his holders, suddenly bowed his head on his hands with a sob of pain.
"Poor Parnell," he cried loudly. "My dead kin."
He sobbed loudly and bitterly. Stephen, raising his terror-stricken face, saw that his father's eyes were full of tears.
That gives you some idea of the passion that the Parnell case aroused. And while people maybe are aware of the aftermath of the case, the actual case itself is not so well known. That's why I invited Senior Counsel Frank Callanan to tell me about it.
Catherine O'Shea was married to William Henry O'Shea. He was a not very successful individual, either in business or in politics. He had just turned his hand to politics. He had been elected for Mayo in the 1880 election. To promote his political career, Catherine made a series of attempts to meet Parnell. He didn't turn up at any of the dinners to which she invited him. And she then, with her sister, Anna Steele, went down to the House of Commons, went into Palace Yard, sent in a card for Parnell, and Parnell came out, and there was something of a coup de foudre, I suppose. That was in the summer of 1880, and their affair, from the correspondence, they were clearly lovers by October 1880, and that affair lasted for the remainder of Parnell's life until the catastrophe of the split, and he married Catherine in June 1891, 4 months before his death.
I suppose it's not surprising that people often refer to Parnell as being the uncrowned king of Ireland at that time, and his destiny was to be changed radically by his liaison with Catherine. But the divorce itself, could you give us the context of how that was dealt with? It would have been an English divorce at the time, wasn't it?
It was a divorce in England under English law, under the Matrimonial Causes Act of 1857 and of 1884. There wasn't any equivalent legislation in Ireland at the time. If you were living in Ireland and wanted a divorce, you had to, in fact, present a private bill in the House of Commons after 1800 if you wished to be divorced. So that was a cumbersome, complex, and, as you can imagine, very expensive procedure. But that didn't matter because Captain O'Shea and his wife were domiciled in England, and he instituted his divorce proceedings on the 24th of December 1889, and that proceeded to trial in England. There was a lengthy delay of about a year before the proceedings came on for hearing. When they did come on for hearing, unlike a situation today, the proceedings were public. They were reported in the press like any other type of proceedings. And in this case, if one turns to the London Times for the 2 days of the hearing, the 15th and 17th of November 1890, one finds 4 pages of tightly packed print which contain the entirety of the evidence before the jury in the divorce case.
I think we have an example of that we might just listen to.
A number of people assembled outside the court before the public were admitted to it. The galleries, which were open to the public, were packed. The Solicitor General, Sir E. Clarke, Mr. Inderwick, QC, and Mr. Lewis Coward appeared for the petitioner, Captain O'Shea. Mr. Lockwood, QC, and Mr. Pritchard for Mrs. O'Shea, the respondent. Mr. Parnell was not represented. Mr. Lewis Coward, in opening the pleadings, stated that the petitioner, Captain O'Shea, sought a dissolution of the marriage with his wife, Catherine O'Shea, on the grounds of her adultery with the correspondent, Mr. Charles Stewart Parnell. The respondent denied that she had been guilty of adultery, as did also the correspondent. The respondent alleged that the petitioner had been guilty of connivance in the adultery, of conduct that had been conducive to adultery, that he had wilfully separated himself from the respondent, that he himself had been guilty of adultery, that he had unreasonably delayed instituting the suit, and that he had been guilty of cruelty towards the respondent. The petitioner denied all of these allegations, and those were issues that the jury would have to try.
There was a jury who had an entitlement to intervene in the proceedings and did in fact do so, which may reflect a degree of scepticism about the truthfulness of the evidence of Captain O'Shea, or at least about the completeness of the account which he gave as a witness, as the petitioner in the divorce proceedings, which was he had a strange story to tell, and it begged as many questions as it answered. While there was counsel present on behalf of Catherine O'Shea, his instructions were to ask no questions and not to challenge the evidence in any way. And in that situation of rather unsatisfactory, anticlimactic, I suppose, default situation, a couple of members of the jury themselves felt prompted to query the story of Captain O'Shea. The other feature of the case that is perhaps strange to the contemporary eye is that there was a public official called the Queen's Proctor, who was a Treasury solicitor who represented the Crown in the probate and divorce division of the English High Court. And the role of the Queen's Proctor was as a kind of defender of public morality in the matter of divorce, in that the Queen's Proctor could intervene in the proceedings to avoid collusion, to avoid a situation which I think became very common in England in the 1960s, where couples who wanted to get divorce in a fault divorce regime would contrive situations in hotels in the south of England so as to effectively release each other from their matrimonial bonds through a form of law. To avoid that, this individual, the Queen's Proctor, had an entitlement to intervene in proceedings. And the role of the Queen Proctor, it's not just a legal curiosity, it's extremely politically significant in the Parnell case, because the fixed point of Parnell's strategy, he was in love with Catherine O'Shea, they had been living almost as husband and wife for almost a decade. What Parnell was absolutely determined about was that once the issue had been engaged legally, once the issue had been raised publicly, he was absolutely insistent that there had to be a divorce. And obviously his preference would be that it would be a divorce on Catherine's counterclaim against O'Shea on the grounds of his misbehaviour. But that would have involved an ability to conclude a settlement with Captain O'Shea, which, if he had been prepared to enter into such a settlement, would have involved the payment of a very large amount of money, which Parnell and Catherine could not lay their hands on. So the situation, therefore, was, in terms of Parnell's position, that if there was going to be a divorce, if he couldn't induce O'Shea to consent to a divorce against him, it was going to have to be on the basis that O'Shea got his divorce. So for O'Shea's petition to succeed, the evidence against Parnell was, and against Catherine, was damning, suggestive of deception and dishonesty on their part, of the betrayal by her of her husband, and of the use by Parnell of a variety of subterfuges to carry on an illicit affair, supposedly without O'Shea's knowledge. It wasn't a very convincing story, and that's perhaps why the members of the jury intervened. But as you can imagine, how it played politically was another matter, and it was catastrophic for Parnell.
I notice in the course of this you're mentioning you pronounce the word Parnell. Are we all pronouncing it incorrectly?
Well, in Ireland, I suppose he's always been known as Parnell rather than Parnell.
Yes.
The only reason I say Parnell is that Catherine, in her memoirs, says he disliked people calling him Parnell.
Just focusing in, Frank, on the court case itself, I'd be very interested to know how that was presented, what evidence was produced, and how they went about that in respect of how it would differ to today.
Well, the main evidence was simply that of Captain O'Shea himself to his own counsel, Sir Edward Clark. He presented the picture of a husband betrayed. It was a fairly tricky undertaking because it spans a period of 9 years where he's perfectly well aware on his own case that Parnell is spending a great deal of time in the company of his wife in Eltham while O'Shea is in London.
Was that the family home?
Yes, but it really was where Catherine lived pretty much on her own, because the marriage, there wasn't a great deal left of the marriage by 1880 when Parnell met Captain O'Shea.
It would be interesting to hear what that sounded like.
Amongst these letters, did you write one on August the 20th, 1886, to the effect that it would not be advisable to do anything until your return?
Yes, but that had reference to my children.
And did you write in that letter that the proposal to live in Brighton and go to Eltham frequently had the objection that it would not alter the scandal, that it would be necessary to seek the advice of a third person, and that she should hold no communication either directly or indirectly with Mr. Parnell? Did you suggest that she should consult either Sir Evelyn Wood or her solicitor?
Yes.
Did she object?
Yes.
On September the 13th, 1886, did you write a letter repeating the condition that there should be no communication with Mr. Parnell and that she would have a room prepared for you at Eltham in order that you might live in the house?
Yes.
And the letter stated that the condition was suggested by her brother as the only way of mitigating the scandal. Did you write other letters insisting upon her giving an undertaking to cease all correspondence with Mr. Parnell?
Of course.
Did you in 1886 see a paragraph in the Sussex Daily News stating that Mr. Parnell was staying at Eastbourne and that you knew where he lived?
Yes.
Did you write to your wife on the subject?
Yes, immediately.
Did she get from her letter to this effect that she did not know anything about Mr. Parnell's movements and did not see why she should be expected to know anything?
Yes.
The following day you wrote to her denying that you had attempted to put her name in the papers again and saying that one of the effects of its having been there was to put an end to your public life, and you said that if she would consult her solicitor, he would advise her in the interest of the children not to see Mr. Parnell again?
Yes.
In December 1886, was your son in town with you, and did you take him to a boxing tournament at the Cannon Street Hotel for the benefit of Jem Mace?
Yes.
In the course of the evening, did you see an announcement in the Pall Mall Gazette that Mr. Parnell had been staying with you at Eltham?
Yes.
Did you speak to your son about it?
I showed him the paragraph and expressed myself as extremely annoyed, and I asked him, was it true?
Did you write a letter to the Observer?
I immediately telegraphed a reply to the Pall Mall Gazette, hoping that it would catch the late edition, and also the Observer, the next day being Sunday. They put in a paragraph denying the statement.
Was the next thing you saw a paragraph in the St. Stephen's Review in the early part of 1887?
Yes.
And what was done with regard to that?
I immediately wrote to Mrs. O'Shea.
The other cast of characters in the divorce court were servants. A caretaker called Caroline Pethers was a particularly significant witness because while her evidence was in some ways inconsequential, it had huge effects in terms of the ridicule it brought upon Parnell.
I think we have an example of that we might just listen to.
I am a widow and reside at Cheltenham. I am a professed cook. Towards the end of 1883, I was put into number 8 Medina Terrace, West Brighton, as caretaker. My husband was then living. I acted as cook and my husband as manservant. 2 or 3 days after Captain and Mrs. O'Shea had taken the house, a gentleman appeared. I recognised his photograph. He went by the name of Mr. Charles Stewart. I now know it was Mr. Parnell. He sometimes called when Captain O'Shea was at home. He was nearly always there when Captain O'Shea was away. He always came to the house Beach way. He wore a light cloth cap over his eyes. He drove out at night with Mrs. O'Shea, but never in the daytime. They were nearly always locked in a room together.
Had you any directions given to you by Mrs. O'Shea with reference to her visitors?
I was directed to say that Mrs. O'Shea was not at home if visitors called. Mr. Parnell never slept in the house when Captain O'Shea was at home, but he did so frequently when Captain O'Shea was away. He slept in a room used by the captain as a dressing room on the 3rd floor.
On one occasion, do you remember Captain O'Shea calling when Mr. Parnell was in the drawing room?
Yes. I went up to light the gas. The door was locked. I heard persons in the room, but I could not get in. Mrs. O'Shea said it did not matter about the gas. Captain O'Shea rang the front door bell. My husband answered it. Captain O'Shea went into the dining room and then went upstairs. And 10 minutes after that, Mr. Parnell rang the front door bell and asked to see Captain O'Shea.
Could he have gone down by the stairs?
No. There was a balcony outside the drawing room. There were 2 rope fire escapes from the window. This happened 3 or 4 times. On these occasions, Mr. Parnell was in the sitting room, and he did not come down the staircase. I remember one occasion when Mrs. O'Shea and Mr. Parnell were in the drawing room until midnight. Mr. Parnell came out first and went upstairs. Mrs. O'Shea followed him upstairs. She went into Mr. Parnell's bedroom. My husband and I were on the landing above, and I saw them both go into the bedroom. We waited outside some time, and then went to bed. They were still in the bedroom when we went to bed.
The idea of this famously dignified, impassive politician escaping via a fire escape to avoid an irate husband was something that was obviously damaging to Parnell's popular standing, and was something that in particular entertained his conservative enemies in England.
I'd imagine. And did Parnell actively defend this? Or what was his stance in the court?
No, Parnell was really trying to operate through Catherine's counsel, and the way things played out, the situation where they both wanted a divorce, there wasn't very much he could do. And there is a very interesting situation where Parnell has a furious row with Sir Frank Lockwood, who appeared for Catherine, because in an attempt to square the irreconcilable requirements of the situation, Parnell had hit on what in a way is quite a clever idea. He wanted Frank Lockwood to challenge O'Shea's account, to put, I suppose, counter-allegations to O'Shea, to effectively sketch out Parnell's defence without, however, Parnell going into evidence.
Oh, I see.
And Lockwood refused to do that as a barrister. Mm. And I think Lockwood was probably right about that. He would have been fiercely criticised, as you could imagine, if he had put allegations to O'Shea which he didn't call evidence to support. And he had a further row with Lockwood in relation to his concern that O'Shea would end up with custody of his children by Catherine.
Was the custody issue fought out in the same case?
It was, I suppose we would say, parked. I mean, O'Shea was shrewd enough not to press the custody thing.
How was that resolved in the end? Did the children end up with Parnell and Catherine?
Oh, they remained with Parnell and Catherine. They had three children. The first child died in infancy. There were two further daughters born in the course of the 1880s to Parnell and Catherine, one of whom resembled Parnell in a quite remarkable way. But of course, by legal fiction, they were deemed the children of Captain O'Shea.
Frank, you mentioned the jury intervening and asking questions. Fascinated to know how that would have happened, what they said, how they did it.
Effectively, a couple of members of the jury put a series of questions which O'Shea tried to deal with, and they were touching on areas where the evidence of O'Shea as the outraged husband had strained the credulity of the jury. But the reason why this figure whom I mentioned, the Queen's proctor, was more than a legal curiosity was that once O'Shea got his divorce decree, it was essential that that decree was made absolute. The way it was done was you got, in the first instance, a conditional decree, a so-called decree nisi of divorce. And after 6 months, the petitioner could apply to have the decree of divorce made absolute. And for Parnell to ensure that Catherine O'Shea was divorced so that he was free to marry her, it was essential not merely that O'Shea get his conditional decree of divorce, as he did in November 1890, but that he also got that decree made absolute 6 months later. The snag from one of the many legal snags in this arrangement from Parnell's point of view was that over that 6 month period, this public official, the Queen's proctor, could intervene in the proceedings if there was any evidence of impropriety on the part of the petitioner, if there was anything to suggest connivance or collusion. In the interests of public morality, the Queen's proctor could intervene. And this is something I think that's been largely lost to history, the extent to which Parnell's hands were tied in the split. Mm. Parnell couldn't say very much about Captain O'Shea in the public forum without risking precipitating the intervention of the Queen's proctor and putting in jeopardy the divorce that he wanted to enable him to marry Catherine. Thereafter, politically, Parnell could never put his side of the case. And something that was very important in Parnell's view, he believed that he both said when the divorce petition was first presented in the only statement he really made about the divorce, the only statement he could afford to make, he suggested that O'Shea was effectively acting in league with his enemies. At that stage, the seriousness of Parnell's situation became serious.
It happened very rapidly after
the
divorce. Give me the chronology of that. I mean, it seemed to be almost within a year.
Oh, the whole event, it's an extraordinarily compressed
series
of events. The divorce is in mid-November. The Irish party meet then in later November 1890. Parnell loses the leadership of the Irish party after the debates in committee room 15. The first by-election of the split took place in North Kilkenny in December, which Parnell lost. There were abortive attempts to negotiate a settlement of the split in Boulogne in December to February 1891. They were unsuccessful. The second by-election of the split took place in North Sligo in April. Parnell's position showed a moderate degree of improvement. On the 25th of June, Parnell married Catherine O'Shea in a registry office in
That was because they couldn't get a vicar to marry them.
That's correct. Mm. The timing of this was in a way his last high romantic gesture. At the time of the marriage, there was a by-election pending in Carlow. Any sane, calculating politician in Parnell's situation would have deferred the marriage until after the by-election. Parnell absolutely refused. He was hammered in the by-election in Carlow. He was never a very strong man. Physically, he was subject to serious illnesses throughout the 1880s. The physical strain of the split was immense because what Parnell was doing was campaigning in Ireland at the weekends. He would then return over the week to Brighton, travelling overland on Leary, Euston, London, Brighton,
and then doing the same journey back. Catherine?
He died in Brighton with Catherine on the 6th of October, 1891.
So in every respect, you've described how this case not only changed his life, but changed the lives of many, and in many respects, even the destiny of this country. Frank Callaghan, it's been a great pleasure listening to you, bringing us on this very interesting conducted tour into the life and the case of the divorce of Parnell. Thank you.
Thank you.